The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Welcome back to the Sunday Scotch Society. I am the inevitable, the inescapable, the ubiquitous, the omnipresent. I will not call myself omnipotent, but some people believe that I am arrogant enough to think myself omniscient. I won't say whether or not I agree with those people who have that unfortunate view of me, but I am K. Quincy Parker.
Thanks for having me, K. Quincy Parker.
Thanks for having you where?
Back.
What are you talking about?
It's been an episode or two where I've been missing.
Yes. The voice that you are hearing is, of course, that of my co-pilot, partner in crime, His Excellency Matthew B. Kelly.
Good day.
Matthew and I are particularly excited about today here on the Sunday Scotch Society. We have a guest.
I was, until she was frowning at me.
She's just jealous because you're still eating. We have a guest that we've been searching high and low to get on the show. And now that we have her trapped with us, there is an astonishing array of subjects upon which she is qualified to offer discourse. And we will try our best to get through as many of them as we can in a reasonable amount of time. The guest on today's show will wait for the traditional opening moments in which we discuss what is the dram of the day. And today's dram is especially delightful. The Macallan 12-year-old double cask single malt scotch. The history in this bottle is incredible. I will tell you some of the story, I suppose, as we go through. But the most important thing is not the story, but the whiskey itself. And as such, I will do the thing, and we will sally forth on our journey with the Macallan. We will also, in due course, be trying the Sherry Oak Range and some of the other more exclusive bottles of the Macallan throughout the course of the next few months. Matthew did interesting flourish with his fingers, forgetting for a moment that we're an audio medium at the moment. And now for the first, even before we begin with the nose, the aroma in the room has already been significantly altered just by pouring this scotch. I can already smell some vanilla. I can already smell maybe some nut notes. Of course, there is the very light smoke that I can already smell, and now I'm going to dive in with the nose. And just by way of those of you who may be doing this along with us, when you are nosing a scotch, you want to keep your mouth open so that the fumes and the aroma don't burn your nose and destroy your ability to really enjoy the scents that are in there. So Matthew, having stuck your nose in it, what can you tell us?
Well, it's got a few sweet notes, with vanilla for sure, sort of classic butterscotch, and the color on that is, I'm going to say medium to deep amber.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
One of the things that Macallan is very proud of is that they are in 1% of Scotch makers who do not add color to their product. It comes from the water and the casks.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of the casks is something else. So next week we'll have a conversation with Reed Parker, who is the Macallan specialist for the Caribbean. And I'll ask him to tell us stories about how the casks are made and the process by which we get these Macallan offerings. But just by way of whetting our appetite, a couple of months ago, a bottle of Macallan that was originally brewed in 1946, is 80-something years old now, was sold at an auction for $2.7 million. And I have my own feelings about that, but our guest has already made her presence known, and she thought that was... What was it you said?
Nice.
Our guest is going to join us in talking about this scotch now. So I suppose it's only fair to end the suspense. We are joined today by... I don't even know how many different things to call you. But at present, for the moment... we'll call you the co-founder of Crypto Isle, a fintech proponent, someone with a serious resume, the great and terrible Divinia Bang.
Thank you for having me and calling me terrible.
Yes. Great and terrible is an old English phrase that means someone who is exalted. It is also a biblical phrase that has been ascribed to God. So, I'm not calling you God, but...
I already see you default the God accolades earlier.
I mean, if the cap fits, you know what I'm saying? So...
Still quite smooth. Mm-hmm. Spicy. A hint of sandalwood. And... I'll get back to you as we go along, how this develops.
Did you just say it tastes like incense?
No, I said it has a hint of something that is sometimes in certain incenses.
Well, that was horrible to have me on the show to talk about scotch, right? Because, like, you know I'm, like, the worst when it comes to scotch and whiskey. And you bring out probably one of your better bottles.
Definitely one of the better bottles.
To waste on me.
We're not wasting it on you. We're celebrating you with it.
Are you sure?
Yes, absolutely.
Our friendship will stay intact after this.
Well, there's a long way to go.
Yeah,
we will see.
We'll see what happens. You know? For me, I don't find it harsh, fiery, or even that abrasive. For me, this is smooth. It is... This is definitely spicy. It has some of those some of those aromas that we smelled in the nose are definitely present in the taste. For me, I get the vanilla right away. I get the nuttiness right away. And as it opens up in the glass, I think it'll probably mellow out just a little bit for the vineyard.
Right. Yeah, those candied notes for me are in the sip.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't stay on the finish, and that's fine because it's going from a sweet to a more spicy finish. With even, I don't know if this is because I just ate, but just a touch of brine.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, with tasting scotch, trying to say what it tastes like, there is no right or wrong. It's just what it tastes like to you. We better start the show.
I love you both.
Speaking of being into something, then,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you have something that you're into that someone such as myself would be like, you are into this, you've taken this too serious. What would that be?
That you don't know, that's a lie.
I didn't say I don't know, I said I don't know.
Oh, okay, so sorry, my bad.
Things that I love too serious about.
And there are many.
And that's the problem. My work, I'm very serious about my work.
Mm.
And by that I mean my life's work.
And what is your life's work to be?
My life's work is very broadly economic development.
So that is, as you quite rightly say, very broadly. What is in 2024, as you are considering how you are going to survive the wonderful experience of the Macallan 12-year-old double cask?
Yeah, because I'm sitting here trying to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. But you live in the Bahamas at the moment. You have lived elsewhere in the world. You've traveled to a number of places and seen and done quite a bit. So as a person whose life's work, in your own words, is economic development, where would you say the Bahamas is right now if you had to create a scale for economic development to be measured on?
Very interesting question. Parker. That's the scotch kicking in, by the way, now.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so that's not an easy question with an easy answer. Because then you first have to talk about how you measure that, right? How do you measure economic development? Which I don't know if we have that much time.
We have that much time.
But rather than talking about how other people measure it, I think more recently some economists have been trying to measure based on how people feel it. So we always have this situation where the politicians jump up and say, hey, we've done these new hotels with these new beds and these new jobs and blah, blah, blah. And it's a framing of economic development. And then you always have the naysayer that comes along and say, yeah, but what they say, you can't put ketchup on sidewalk.
I've never heard of that one, but okay.
You also can't walk on ketchup.
And you also can't walk on ketchup, right?
I mean, technically, okay. Sorry.
So this barometer of, okay, how are people feeling it? Who may be further away from it? That said, And when you look at where the Bahamas is, one thing we can admit is comparative to some of our Caribbean neighbors, we have very little that we can complain about in the broader scope of things again. While we may be feeling whatever pressures we're feeling, compared to what other places feel in the Caribbean, you sort of lose shame if you try to complain. For example, we often compare to Haiti, where maybe but 5% of that economy are relatively comfortable. 1% is extremely comfortable, and the rest may be in extreme discomfort.
So the disparity spread is not that great here, compared to Haiti.
Compared to other places, no.
Okay.
We have a significant, we've always had a significant middle class. I don't know, based on any real data, how that's changed, if it's widened or shrunk. I don't know. But so if I had to put us on a scale among our Caribbean counterparts, I would say we have to admit that we're among the top. Our journey has definitely been among the top. And our absolute or our static position right now is also among the top. Globally, I don't have a clue. That's way more brain work than someone who just had a sip of McAllen can do.
Well, allow me to draw a comparison to Iceland. So I've been intrigued with them for a while because of a similar population size. They're an island, but obviously the history is very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so the economic systems and impacts of various policies, I think it would be an instructive, if not fair, comparison between the Bahamas and there. To just see, like, okay, what is the wealth disparity like there? What is the economic spread? You know, we have tourism dominating what we're doing. They have tourism just sort of coming up, and they want to develop it some. Their fishing in the north is quite different than fishing in the south, and collapse of fisheries will have impacted them differently. Have you ever done those comparisons? I know you don't want to. You don't want to think too hard because you just had your sip of this excellent amber gold, liquid amber gold. But have you ever thought about the comparisons outside of, like, I know we're quite lucky, so we're not Haiti, right? But without complaining, do you see where we could be doing things better and have compared to, but not just like, okay, say a comparison to the U.S., but perhaps instead to a small town in the U.S., which is more of what our entire population is like.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I think when you take different reference points, the result comes out differently, right? So, let's say that one of the more important KPIs or metrics, whatever word you want to use, for economic development for you may be, you know, your global awareness, your global integration, those types of things. When you compare the Bahamas to the average city or town in the United States, we'll roll them up. Like, half of them don't know the Bahamas being an American city. Half of them don't know nothing about the rest of the world. Half of them don't know a lot about the way money works, the way towns work, the way policy works. The average person sitting in McDonald's bantering about our country is way more in tune with it than I think in some of these small towns in the U.S. than the average person is there. Does that say, hey, they don't need that? They're doing well, or we're doing better. Some people may say so. So again, it comes down to what you feel. I think there's a feeling in the Bahamas about the ability to transform your economic status. Now, I have to be fair that I'm not saying that there aren't groups of people that feel frustrated about an inability to transform, but especially as we look at the movements recently with small businesses, I think there are droves and droves of people now feeling that there is a possibility to transform their economic status through some of the transformations in the ecosystem for small businesses that we've created. That, I think, as I've seen it in other cities in the United States and throughout the Caribbean, I think what we have is quite mature. What's missing, maybe compared to the very advanced cities, like we are not a Silicon Valley type city, but the economic tools that we have available to small business in the Bahamas may be what you have available in the average Hickville city in Minnesota, you know, because we've been deliberate with it. They've been deliberate with it in the very populated areas. What we've done in Long Island and Acklands still, I think, outweighs what some people have done in some of the more rural cities in developed countries.
So I like the fact that you bring to consciousness the idea of how people feel as opposed to what the numbers may say. Because, of course, numbers can be interpreted in any number of different ways. Circular definition. Fun. There's a thing called the misery index, right, which is technically the sum of unemployment and inflation, right? And in the Caribbean, of course, the misery index is incredibly high because of high unemployment and high inflation. And the Bahamas has, you know, Bahamian politicians use the term misery index occasionally without, I don't think, any scientific study or any, you know, objective research to try to quantify what that number might be. But for all that you have said, would you say, given everything that you've said just now, would you say the average Bahamian feels, to use your phrasing, like they could transform their economic circumstances given the state of whatever the overall economic development in the Bahamas is right now?
Again, it's a very risky question, and I'm going to be courageous and answer the way I feel, and then we just welcome opposition when it comes. But yes, I mean, let's look at it. Like I mentioned already, the opportunities available and the changes created for the average person to start a business. Let's look at the changes created for the average person to get a treasury education. Like, UB is free. Even if you don't have good grades, which some people, you know, weren't too happy with. But you could have less than average grades and get a college degree for free. So if any child right now is desirous of a college degree and they're not getting it, then the failure at that point is not on the ability to afford it, it's on our ability to get them through high school well, which is our failure for not getting them through primary school well, which is likely our failure for what we did while they were in kindergarten, right? So it's a collective failure that we all have to figure out how we fix. But for those who actually got through high school and they have some sort of a baseline, those people now have a real opportunity that, frankly, they didn't have before because they had to go to work, right? I mean, there's some basic changes, you know, that we can't ignore. Yes, you know, we have our inflation and all that sort of stuff, but at the same time, we have never had downtown filled with the cruise ships the way we've had. I'm here every day, and before time I would have been missing it, but there is an energy as you drive through downtown every day. Like, there are people on the bus stops from 5 a.m. in the morning, 6 a.m. in the morning, going to work. They ain't out there just sitting on the block, they're waiting for a bus. And I'm talking one, two people. 6 a.m. in the morning, you could easily pass and see 20 people waiting on the bus. These little things signal something to me. Obviously, they got something to do. So, in the absence of data in front of us right now, I think things in general are better.
And you are a trend type person. Do you think, and by that I mean you're familiar with and studious of trends as a financial forecaster, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? So, do you think things are trending to continue that improvement in at least access to opportunity?
Yeah, I think we're trending in the right direction for access to opportunity. There's still problems to be solved. Yes, we have a huge crime problem, but this is always the cycle, right? You start making some economic improvements, and then you say, oh, well, crime's going to pull it all back. Which slightly it did when we had this travel advisory, but that doesn't mean you just negate the fact that things are better in that particular area, even though they're substantially either worse or more transparent in the matter of crime. I think from a trend point of view, I think it's in the right direction. The opportunities are in the right direction. And we have to keep the press on. We can't take a break. Mm-hmm. Or else we'll wake up and be back 15 years ago.
You were the founding executive director of the Access Accelerator Small Business Development Center. You created that... that agency, which was an adaptation of a system from the Organization of American States, and you oversaw its operations for five years.
Not quite five years, right?
So when you talk about access to opportunity, in particular, to start a business, you're not speaking in hypothetical terms. You're talking from a perspective of someone with hands-on experience. Going back at least 4 years, let's call it. So if we want to look at a way of not only cementing that forward momentum, but broadening the scope of forward, upward movement, right, together. What's your prescription? And why are you laughing?
You're a very gutsy interviewer. Must have a lot of courage to ask me that question.
Number one, it's a conversation, not an interview. And number two, yes, I am fueled by Macallan 12-year-old double cast.
Liquid courage.
And also fueled by the presence of Matthew B. Kelly, a co-pilot who can fish me out of the water if I go too deep. And fueled by, what is it? Matthew, why are you moving away? Matthew, why are you backing away?
Fun. I actually would like Matthew to answer first. I promise. Obviously, I will answer that. I will answer with the answer that's already in my head. So I'm not going to adapt my answer post Matthew's. But Matthew, I would love to hear your answer first.
Because Matthew, of course, is a Yeah, he's a business development and storyteller himself. So
I'm not going to steal your thunder.
Come on, man, dude.
Here's my reasoning, right?
For not stealing her thunder, or
yeah, because on a serious note, the listener is going to hear from me over and over and over again, mm-hmm. right? And I'm happy to engage with you on your ideas, etc. But I'm not. This is for you. You take this one, right? That said, I will preface whatever you're going to say with this. There's no one way of thinking about this. Things change on the ground every day. And to ask for a straight-up prescription is asking for a lot of pushback, because you're going to have to simplify. So that's the life raft that I'm throwing to you.
And I'm catching that life raft and destroying it, because I would like to hear the unreserved, unvarnished, unlife rafted.
Okay, you're asking her. I'm going to beat this a little bit, right? Because you're asking her perspective, right? From where she is now, what she thinks could be done with the pressure and influence that those in the room have, which is very different to if she was prime minister, which is very different to, you know, if you got the heirs of cabinet. Like I'm just saying, the perspectives here can be very different. Like, are you asking for the wave, the wand, prescription?
That said, let me answer. Because you rightly started the proper preamble, which is the prescription cannot be singular. Like this singular mouth touch, whatever that is that you told me at the beginning. I don't remember the explanation since 5 minutes ago. And hence, you also use the term cabinet. That's why a cabinet has more than one person in it. Because you gotta focus on multiple things at once, because any one solution can immediately be strained by the absence of solutions in other areas, right? So it is definitely a governmental question and answer. The prescription for something like that has to be top down, bottom up. But it has to be multi-pronged. With all of that preamble said, the one that I am most passionate about in this moment of time is dumb money. I just learned this term at the end of last year. There is actually something called dumb money. Would you guys like to know dumb money?
I very much would like to know.
I would also very much like to know.
Okay. Are you familiar with what smart money is?
Yes.
Matthew, what is smart money?
Smart money is that money that comes along with smarts, i.e. people don't just give it to you and run away. They bring some expertise along with it, so to increase the chances that this money is actually turning an investment.
Right. Excellent. So smart money is a very important piece of the puzzle that we spoke of earlier, mm-hmm. for these new entrepreneurs who feel like they have lots of access to opportunity, because we've introduced some smart money into the system. However, smart money has to be in an ecosystem alongside dumb money. Dumb money is the money that people knowingly invest knowing that it may actually disappear. They may invest in 100 ideas and maybe only one of them come out of it and make sense. So it sounded like that next 99 was a throwaway. But really, what that investment does to those 99 people, one, again, it gives them a chance to work through a concept that might work. Two, it teaches them the ways that it doesn't work. Three, it lets them be a lot less fearful of failure. And this fear of failure is something that is choking our ability to expand our economy into new things. So y'all, people sit down every day, all day, on these talk shows, talking about, oh, we need to diversify from tourism, blah, 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 blah. Who's investing in that diversification? Where is the dumb money for someone to go and try out whether you could grow a light bulb from sand? Where's the dumb money for someone to try out their crazy idea? You might have a 5% chance of making it work, but at least we begin to learn more about how we use our natural resources, our natural circumstances to innovate.
For those people who like concretization, I will read one interesting definition of dumb money that I found on the internet.
It must be true.
I will no longer read that. I will no longer read that that definition.
Come on, man.
Although we may find the term dumb money a bit unflattering, it has two significant implications. Firstly, it suggests that these investors may not add value beyond their capital contribution, as in they lack the relevant expertise or connections to provide useful advice to entrepreneurs, as opposed to the smart money that my esteemed colleague here was talking about. And the second implication is the money is invested in non-traditional structures, which can diminish the likelihood of generating a risk-adjusted return and make it harder for entrepreneurs to secure subsequent funding. In other words, this type of investment can inflate a company's valuation, scaring off future investors. So
I don't like that definition.
That's why. That's why I read it, because it adds a complication to the definition that you were given.
Well, it's not wrong. So we've had some people come to us and say, well, somebody gave me $100,000 and only took 5% of my business, and my business must be worth $5 million. So their valuation's now of $5 million because somebody gave them some dumb money, and they want to assume that that speaks to valuation. No, that speaks to one, your ability to speak fluff fluently. And then two, that speaks to their ability to take a chance on you because, you know, they must have had some excess capacity. But don't come now around me talking about your valuation is $5 million. You can't value on dumb money. You innovate with dumb money, you value on smart money.
Right. So why are you excited about dumb money?
Because people need to get out of their boxes. I'm falling asleep with some of the ideas that people are coming to table with because they're only doing what they think they could sell to you. If they think they could sell you something, that's what I want to do. That's like a child coming to you and saying they want to be a teacher because they know you will always need teachers.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think you need to flesh out why in this particular context that's a bad thing or a non-useful thing.
Oh, right. So let's go back to the context. The context was, given where we are now and where we can be, right, what would I prescribe to help us get there? In this moment in time, the Bahamas needs to become creative. We need the confidence, the resources, the people to become creative. We have the attention of the world, like literally. One, because of what we've done with digital assets. Two, because of what we've done with our tourism industry. I mean, like, I know y'all remember, you should remember from some of the research we did, 5 years ago we were taking licks for how uninnovative our tourism industry was and how far behind we were with bringing in things like smart tech and all sorts of things in the tourism industry. And now, you know, that there's a whole different appreciation for our tourism industry today, right? While we have the world's attention, while we have free treasury education, while we have structures set up to help you build your businesses, let's use that foundation now to do some crazy stuff.
So we need the dumb money so that we can take more risks.
Yes, the money in the Bahamas is too risk averse. Like, literally, like, people are faster putting their money in a mutual fund. I don't know why money still ends up in banks nowadays. That's very interesting. But they put it in these fall asleep opportunities because they're risk averse. And so we need somebody to take the risk on us, even if it's for 5 years. Take the risk on the ideas, the people, the inertia. And after that, we'll see more of the smart money be liberated into the system because we have a balanced system. Dumb money take the risk on crazy ideas. When they prove them themselves, smart money slips in and expands.
Okay, so psychologically, right? I don't think there's anything wrong with humans taking the signals of what's around them and being risk averse. Conversely, if the signals are proper, then you could do the creative things, you could take more risks, etc., right? But if you don't feel safe, you're naturally going to be more risk averse. So I am going to put it to you that perhaps a lot of people don't feel safe. And I want to know from you, where is this money that has enough buffer to feel safe? Where's that money coming from? Who can take that chance? Because it's not going to be me at the moment, right? I have certain priorities, and a lot of people do, and a lot of people are, we used the word average earlier, I assume to mean common, but we all know the technical term, what that means. Well, most people are going to be below average. So it ain't those people. Who in the above average state is it going to be? Is it going to be expats? Is it going to be that the government can get another $500 million loan from the IMF for it? Like,
that's definitely not money. Institutional money.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Like, I don't disagree with you, but I think that the math works out that the majority of the population is not in this conversation. By definition of where they are on the income scale, mm-hmm. and what they could risk. So
where is the dumb money coming from?
Who is the dumb money coming from?
Yeah. Very, very, very good questions.
I would also, as you are thinking, I would like to separate those questions.
Okay.
Matthew asked who, and I asked where. And while it may seem like the same question, as I was listening to the questions, I realized it's actually two separate questions.
Yeah. Technically, people with excess returns, entities with excess returns, especially at certain levels of their growth cycle, set aside funds for different levels of risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost every investment portfolio has a spread on risk.
Right.
What I'm suggesting is the 5% on a conservative portfolio, let's say 3% of it is set aside for something with a slightly higher risk portfolio. That 3% flowing to the Bahamas. meaning the local portfolios that may be conservative with a 3%, 3 to 5% range for something that's less risk averse, somehow we're not getting it. Those who are balanced, they may have, what, say 5 to 10% that's risky. For whatever reason, the average person ain't getting access to that. And those who, listen, I'm early in my game, and I want high returns, so I'm going to have a larger bucket for risky investments. I'm suggesting that the handful of people we let hold our money are not reinvesting the risky part of the portfolios back into
the suggesting that the people who are handling this money have an accountant mentality?
No, I'm suggesting that they're investing in the same people. So it's not risky. If you, the last time you gave an investment from your investment bank was to the same couple of families, but because it's in the class of private equity, you call it risky. Ain't no risk there because you've been giving it to these families all along, so you know what their risk profile is based on their performance. So you haven't taken a risk. So, but the average young behemoth that may come and pitch your investment bank to get a small percentage of that risky part of that portfolio, if their name ain't spelled right, ain't nothing happening. So I'm suggesting that the guards are not truly investing those pieces of that portfolio in ways that could do us all benefit. That said, when you talk about the where part of it, we have to open up. The central bank did an amazing thing. We could bring in up to $5 million of investment with way less friction than before. We need to stop shopping for money in the Bahamas until the local investors see us produce, and then they get jealous.
So that brings me to another question. Yeah, you're too slow, man.
Apparently
I got there first.
Apparently so. Go ahead. That's why.
You're talking about shopping abroad for money. Do you think the higher probability for the businesses that are much more risky but do work out in the end to be non-local based to address a regional or global market?
Absolutely. I mean, you can make no money off of 400,000 people, which half of them, everybody say, have an employment problems, and then the next half young and still in school or already in retirement. So you get a good 80,000 people you can make money off of. Like, you know, you have to be thinking at least regional with your strategies.
That's actually something that has come up in conversation recently with a friend of mine in the diplomatic corps. Some people in the Caribbean laugh at the Bahamas because we refuse to participate in the single market and economy, right? The main objections that I've heard from our politicians over the years center around the free movement of labor, right? They don't want doctors and lawyers and teachers and, you know, contractors from around the Caribbean to have access to this market, even though it would mean that our people also have access to their markets. What I heard one chamber person say was, well, let's be honest, and this is a direct quote. Let me make it a paraphrase. What they said was, let's be honest, everybody know they're looking to come to the Bahamas. They know ain't no Bahamian guy nowhere else. And I thought that that was an unfortunate view for somebody in that position to hold, given the sizes of the economies we're talking about, and given the sizes of the opportunities that might be out there. So I hear you, Matthew, and I know that you have some things to say, but I think that we have dismissed the region as an investment opportunity, both for source of funds and also a market for our enterprise. And I think I would like to place that in the pot of this wonderful brew that we are cooking on.
I'm definitely not dismissive of the Caribbean for source of funds or opportunities to invest in. I think, I think we're missing out severely. I remember there was again, it may have been in chamber-like circles. When discussing the Freeport economy, you know, population size, among other factors, obviously, you know, there's been a lot of challenges over the years with that economy, but population size was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were, up to 50,000 at one point, and then they dropped down to 30,000, and there was no political or policy-based decision to regrow the population size. No intervention from a policy point of view.
The amount, let me rephrase, amount is the wrong word. The number of Bahamian communities, neighborhoods, towns that have died because of the population shift to New Providence continues to grow. But if we are to be honest and fair, this is where the economic opportunity is. And so Freeport, as wonderfully well as it's laid out, is not going... It is laid out wonderfully well.
Let's hear the words.
We'll get to urban design at some point on this podcast. But suffice it to say that there are pros and cons to the way that Freeport is laid out. It's not a universal, like, you're not going to get universal agreement on your statement. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay then.
Freeport is laid out wonderfully well.
Yeah.
Cheers to Freeport.
To Freeport, though. The 51st state.
not right when I swallowed the scotch, man. Come on.
My Freeport people know I love them, man.
Just to tie in the reference to Freeport and the population, because I know that may sound like it went left.
No.
With this idea of not being dismissive of the rest of the Caribbean, when you look at what it is that you're selling, especially if it has, you know, cross-border benefits,
mm-hmm.
the more people you get to sell to, the more money you make.
Okay, so this is where my face went kind of wonky when it was mentioned about the doctors and the lawyers, etc. Here's the thing. Simple multiplication. If I go to Trinidad and my salary is half of what it is here, right, it's half of what it is here. If I take my business to Trinidad and my prices have to be half of what they are here, that just means I need to make twice the sales and then I'm good.
No, because you have to talk about the inputs. Your inputs may be 75%
Everything else being equal. I'm just saying.
But everything else isn't equal.
But listen to my point.
Okay.
That a lawyer or a doctor and other solo practitioners,
okay.
right,
mm-hmm.
essentially they're getting salaries, right?
Okay.
And even though cost of living may be lower in these places where you're getting paid less, is other factors can offset that as well, including the difficulties of having foreign currencies. I hear people from Trinidad complaining to me all the time about U.S. accounts, U.S. dollar accounts, etc., right? But if all else is equal and I'm being paid less. But if my market is expanding and my company is making more sales, that's a difference. So what I'm saying is you can't just have one yardstick for all quote unquote businesses. It really depends on the model.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And if we did have an open economy, right?
The example isn't flawed after all. Yeah.
Then medical services are going to cost less because we got a higher supply of doctors. Great, but that means that the doctors are going to make less here, right? So these people are not crazy.
Well,
they may be short-sighted, though.
I do not disagree with that.
Again, from a point of policy, we've been short-sighted because, okay, so lawyers and doctors make less. Like, how much of us is a lawyer and doctor anyway? There's 40,000 people living here. We can't make a policy on 900 lawyers and doctors. We can't make a policy on the average person.
Industry by industry, worker class by worker class.
The only reason I don't disagree with that, Matthew, but the reason I brought it up was because we as a community, as a society, as a country, are not even willing to have the conversation.
Yeah, that's silly.
And to me, that's part of the challenge of when Davinia says we have to open up for sources of dumb money, for instance. We can't even talk about free movement of labor between us and other successful economies in the region.
Yeah.
And we're going to thank Davinia for her time with us there. We'll pull a stop here for the Guardian Talk Radio audience because we only have an hour with them. So thank you very much for this time, Davinia. You are a treasure trove. Delighted to talk to you. Matthew, you have any words for 19?
Other than thank you, no.
And the scotch. The beautiful scotch. Yeah, yeah. Does that over you.
See you.
See ya.
Check it out.